than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. And now, another exciting episode in the Adventures of Superman.
This is Mike, and welcome back to Comics in the Golden Age. I'm going to welcome a very special guest tonight, Mr. Jim Nolte. Jim, thank you very much for being here. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Jim is something of a super fan, excuse me, if you forgive the pun, of the Adventures of Superman TV show, and in particular of actor George Reeves. So I've asked him to come on and talk to us about that tonight. Jim has been pretty actively involved in the fandom of the show for a long time, and he's actually met or corresponded with a large number of the people involved in the show, both on and off the screen. Jim also has quite a fascinating website. He's done quite a bit of research and has created a calendar of important events involving both the show and George Reeves in particular. Jim, what's the address for that website?
That would be jimnolte.com.
Thank you. He also has a great Twitter account where he posts a lot of those dates and events regularly from there, and I'm a follower, and I enjoy it very much. He also has a Facebook group as well dedicated to the show. Jim, what's the name of that Facebook group again?
And that's The Adventures Continue.
Thank you. So I'd encourage everyone who's on either of those social medias to check that out and to check out his website as well. And also, Jim, just so people know, what's your Twitter handle?
Jim Nolte. Jim Nolte, yeah.
Great. Easy enough. So first of all, I want to kind of go back to the very beginning. If you could tell me about your introduction to the Adventures of Superman TV show.
I first encountered George Reeves in 1953. It came to local television in the spring of 53. I missed the first episode, but I caught the second one, and I've been watching ever since.
Now, had you read Superman comics prior to this series? Or?
No. The television series is my introduction to Superman. And therefore, naturally, George is very strongly identified with Superman. Later, I happened to see some Superman comic books, and I thought, wow, here's a comic book based on the television show that I'm watching. Little did I know it was the other way around.
Now, I know it's been a while, and this may not be the easiest question to answer, but if you could kind of, to the best of your recollection, like when you sat down as a little kid to watch this, what kind of impact did this show have on you?
Well, it's had an almost 70-year impact on me. I can remember watching the first episodes, and the first one I saw was The Haunted Lighthouse, and near the end, the crook takes a knife and puts it against Superman's chest, and the knife bends, and I just couldn't quite understand what was going on there, but it fascinated me. And I thought it had something to do. I thought that shield on his chest, the S shield, was somehow metal or something like that, and that's what bent the knife. So I started playing Superman soon after that, and I used an old sheriff's badge, you know, that you get with a gun and holster set, and I pinned that badge onto my T-shirt, and that's what I thought would protect me. It didn't take me long, though, to figure out what was actually going on.
I hope you weren't one of the kids that tried to fly and jump from too high or anything like that.
I tried to fly many times, but always from a takeoff on the ground, never out a window.
Good, good. So before later I want to talk a little bit about your experiences meeting some of the people and all, but for a little bit I just want to focus on the show itself. Are there any particular standout episodes, favorites you have?
Yes, the second season, Around the World with Superman, when he meets a blind girl and he has to convince her that Superman is real. And he does, and then he restores her sight and takes her on a trip around the world. That was just amazing to me, and it's still my favorite.
One of the things I like about that one is George Reeves' performance in particular. I thought that was one where he really did just a wonderful job. Some of the ones I like the most are ones where, you know, he kind of gets an opportunity to sort of, because some, I mean, as much as I love the show, some of the episodes are pretty by the book and such, or could be repetitive at times. So I do appreciate when George got the chance to kind of shine and such. There was one I kind of enjoy. It could be campy at times, but where he got to play the gangster. I think it was Boulder was the gentleman's name, but I'm blanking. I'm terrible with names of episodes, but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Boulder was the character's name, yes.
What are your thoughts as far as seasons? Because so I know a lot of people consider sort of the first season to be the best. What's your opinion?
Well, I'm torn between the first and second seasons. I enjoy the first season's grittiness, but I also knew, met, had lunch with, corresponded with Whit Ellsworth, and I came to know him fairly well. And because of that, I have an affection for the second season episodes as well. So I would say the black and white years are my favorite years, and include the first and second seasons.
Oh, so you, I was going to get to this later, but I have to follow up because you mentioned him. You got to actually meet and correspond with Whitney Ellsworth, who I'm sure anyone listening to this would know, but just in case they don't, of course, Whitney Ellsworth was an editor and writer with DC Comics who ended up, you know, going to Hollywood. He got involved in this show. He was, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was a story editor and a writer of episodes and a producer as well. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Okay. He was editorial director at DC.
What year did you first meet him? Do you recall?
1980. Yeah. Okay.
So that was not, he passed away fairly soon after that, is it?
We had lunch in July of 1980, and he passed away in September.
Oh, wow. So how did you meet him? Did you just reach out by letter to him, or how did you first get introduced?
Well, we have to go back to 1976, I think, with Gary Grossman published a book called Superman Serial to Serial.
I know it well.
Now, I had watched the series from 1953 through the 60s. When I went to college, I actually arranged my schedule of classes so that I could watch Superman during the day. And but there, I didn't know how to do anything with that interest. It was, and as far as I was concerned, I was the only one who had the intense interest that I did. And then Gary's book came out in 1976, and that just rekindled the flame in me. And it also allowed me to know that there were others who cared about the series. And so I thought, I want to find those people. It allowed me to know, too, that Jack Larson was still alive, and Noel and Phyllis, because they had not done any, there weren't very many shows like Entertainment Tonight or anything like that up until the 70s. And so I think the first thing I did, I really can't remember exactly, but the first thing I did was to write to Dabbs Greer, because he was doing Little House on the Prairie at that time. So I wrote to him at NBC, and he replied. And I just cannot recall how I got in contact with Whit Ellsworth, but I did. I wrote to him. He wrote back thanking me for the letter and not brushing me off, but I could tell he expected that to be a once and done thing, but I couldn't let it go. So I wrote back, and soon he was inviting me to have lunch with him in his home in Westlake Village.
Did he appreciate, do you think, how much this show meant to so many people? I mean, what impact it really had on people like yourself?
Oh, he was amazed. He was amazed that it was still that it was still running in reruns, and that there was an audience for it. Yes, he was just flabbergasted for the most part.
Now, was he aware of that before he met you, or was he kind of checked out on the status of the show or the legacy?
Gary Grossman had interviewed him for his book in 76. I didn't start corresponding with Witt until about 78, 79. And so, yes, he was aware of it when I approached him.
I'm going to backtrack for just a minute, a little more, just getting back to the show and one thing I wanted to talk about. And we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but, you know, obviously, we lost George at a younger age. It was a very tragic loss. I do have to ask, for someone of, you know, watching this as a child, when you heard, if you don't want to get into it, I understand, but just what was it like to experience that loss at the time?
Well, you know, many years later, I talked with Jack Larson about it, and he said he was permanently saddened by George's death, is the way he put it, and I knew exactly what he meant. I think I was permanently saddened by his death also. I remember reading it in the paper on June. He died on June 16th. It was in our local paper the following day on the 17th. And I just looked at the article. I read it, reread it. I was 12 at the time. And it's just had a profound effect on me.
You know, of course, a lot of people have probably heard about the mixed feelings George had on the role, you know, its impact on his career, things like that. But one thing I always have consistently heard, which tells me a lot about him as a person, is his love of interacting with children, how working at charities, being around them. Is that sort of consistent with how you've heard of him over the years, the way he was with kids?
Yes.
Of that aspect.
I have a YouTube video in which I pay tribute to George, and I mentioned that it was during his years playing this strange visitor from another planet that he was given the opportunity to show his human side. He did visit hospitals. He enjoyed meeting with the children. The only thing that bothered him was the fact that he really wasn't Superman. And he was always worried that some emergency would come up that he couldn't handle, and he'd have to be there in front of the children and have to explain to them why he couldn't prevent what was happening. So that was his greatest fear.
Hiya, boys and girls. There can only be one Superman, of course. Did you ever think about some of the super things that you can do for yourself? Well, like saving up the money for your own vacation or for that new bike that you wanted so much. Well, all you have to do is just put away part of your allowance or your odd job money and put it in United States savings stamps at school. Those dimes, quarters, and dollars add up mighty fast, especially when you buy them every week on stamp day. Well, the first thing you know, you'll have enough for a savings bond, just like Dad buys for the payroll savings at work. And from then on, the sky's the limit. Take it from Superman. Your mom and dad will be plenty proud of you if you're learning to save regularly. And the teachers are on your team, too. They make sure of having savings stamps at school for you to buy and remind you when it is stamp day. And so, boys and girls, be super citizens and have a super future by saving regularly with United States savings stamps at school. And keep on making me and everyone else as proud of you as we are today. Bye now.
Now, you've done a lot of research over the years into George and read a lot about him and talked to all these actors who work with him, you know, the other people in the crew and stuff. What are some of your thoughts or opinions on George Reeves as a person?
Well, I don't want to make George Reeves out to be a saint, because he certainly wasn't. He was a human being, and he had his faults, just like everybody else. At the same time, I have talked to many people, including his ex-wife, and no one that I've ever talked to had a negative thing to say about George. He was a fun-loving fellow. He was generous and he cared about people. Don't know what more I can say other than that. He was just liked by virtually everybody who knew him.
Are there any particular performances, you know, films or shows he was in besides The Adventures of Superman that you're particularly fond of or you think you'd recommend to people?
Yes, I love him in The Blue Gardenia with Raymond Burr and Richard Conte. He's very good in that. And, of course, he'll proudly win Yale. And there's a Charlie Chan film, Dead Men Tell, that I enjoy his performance there.
Oh, I have to see.
Superman is by far the venue that I connect with him the most.
I'm Lois Lane. I'm a reporter on the Metropolis Daily Planet. This is my own story.
You had mentioned kind of how you got into talking to some of the other actors and people behind the show. I want to kind of talk to you about a few of the other actors prominently. Now, obviously, Robert Shane, you know, Inspector Henderson. We have Noelle Neal and Phyllis Coates, who played Lois Lane. Jack Larson is Jimmy Olsen. Unfortunately, the actor who played Perry White passed away fairly shortly after the show ended, if I recall correctly. So, unfortunately, he wouldn't have been a possibility as well. Kind of considering that, how did you sort of first get to talk to Noelle Neal?
I had a friend whose wife had a connection to Noelle, and I got Noelle's address through him. And again, I just started writing, and whatever I said must have struck a chord with them because we began a correspondence, and I knew Noelle for 30 years.
I was able to meet her twice at conventions, and beginning, I think, the first time in the early 90s. And she was delightful, incredibly sweet. And at that time, she was very proud of her involvement in the show and loved talking to the fans and such. Like, she just, her enthusiasm was just amazing. When you met her back then, was that already there? Was she that way about the show? Had she sort of embraced it, or did that not come yet?
Yes. She answered the telephone, Lois Lane, and her answering machine answered it that way also. And I'm happy to say that I don't know if I should say happy, but I spoke at her memorial service. I was asked to speak at her memorial service, and I was glad to do that. She was a delightful person, very sensitive though. And I think she could have done much more in show business, but she just did not like rejection. None of us do, but actors have to get used to that. And I think that's one thing about acting that she never quite got used to, the rejection that you have to put up with sometimes.
Being of a sensitive nature, I imagine joining a show that's already been ongoing for a year must have been a particularly stressful experience for her.
Well, of course, she had played Lois Lane in the serials with Kirk Allen in 48 and 50, so she was familiar with the character. But yes, stepping into the role after they had done a full season, she must have seen some difficulty there.
One of the things we mentioned earlier is there, I think, a tense moment with, I don't know, call if it's a director or someone on the set when she first joined the show, like George Reeves stood up for her and spoke on her behalf to kind of diffuse the situation.
That's well documented. Tommy Carr had a little problem with her and said that's not the way Phyllis would have done it. And of course that hurt. And she, as Noelle says it, I shed a few tears, and then George came to my rescue and said, you know, you can't expect her to work together the same way we have been doing. Give her a second chance, and then everything was okay after that.
That's great to hear of George doing that, though. Shows what his personality was like.
He came to the rescue also with Bob Shane. Bob Shane had been accused of being a communist back in the early 50s in the first season. And Kellogg's was asking that he be removed from the series. And George, Whit Ellsworth and George stood up for him and said, we're not going to do that. You get rid of him and we will go along with him.
Wow. I don't know if I'd heard that before.
Yeah.
And is your name Kent?
No, sir. My name is Jimmy Olsen, Chief.
Don't call me Chief.
Now, Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen, do you recall how you first came to meet him?
Again, through a letter. That was that was the only way in those days, except telephone, and I didn't have a number for him. So, again, I just started writing, and he wrote back, and by the time 2014 rolled around, I hosted a luncheon in Los Angeles, and I reunited Jack with John Hamilton's son. John Hamilton died in 1958. John's son, who was 19 at the time that his father died, was going into the service. And over the years, Jack said to me several times, "Have you ever heard anything about John's son?" And I said, "No, I had no way of." John had no family other than his son. And so I said, "No, I don't know anything." And he asked me a couple of times about it. And finally, I have a friend in Canada who is good at finding people through the internet. And I mentioned it to him, and he said, "Do you want me to give it a try?" And I said, "Yes, I'd like that very much." So within a week, he came back with a list of names and numbers of John Hamilton's across the country. And bingo, the first one I called, I got an answering machine, and I said, I introduced myself and explained what I wanted. And if he was John Hamilton's son, would he please give me a call? And he did. And for 18 months, I was talking to him, and I said, "You know, Jack would really like to see you again." And he said, "Well, he doesn't know. He doesn't tell his friends, really, that his father was John Hamilton. He doesn't like to make a big deal out of it." And I said, "Well, listen, I'm organizing a luncheon in Los Angeles, and we're going to honor Jack. And I would really like for you to be there." And then I didn't hear from him. It went 2 weeks, and I thought, well, I lost him. And the night before the luncheon, I was sitting on the patio at the Beverly Garland Hotel, and John Hamilton walked up to me, and he said, "I'm here." So they had not seen each other in 57 years. So the following day at the luncheon, they gave each other a great big hug.
So in all those years, you were the first person sort of in fandom to be able to track him down.
Right.
Get him involved in any way in this world.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Oh, it must have made Jack Larson so happy.
Oh, he called me the following week. He said, "That was an extraordinary day." And I said, "I'm glad you feel that way, Jack." And not only did he get to meet John Hamilton's son, but his wife and his John Hamilton's son is also named John. His daughter, who took a real liking to each other.
That's great. Now, when you started talking to Jack Larson, you kind of mentioned earlier how much Noelle Neal, how she'd embraced this. She was, you know, really proud of her involvement. She sort of was really open and wonderful with the fans. What was Jack Larson's sort of perspective on all this when you first got to know him?
For many years, Jack shied away from Superman. As he put it, "I tried to hide from Superman," because he wanted to do serious writing. He wrote opera librettos and plays. And he and his partner produced several movies. Mike's Murder with, I can't think of her name now. So he wanted to escape Superman. But as the years went on, that changed. And by the time of that luncheon in 2014, his closing remarks were, "I now love Superman and I love you."
I was wondering because by the time I saw him, I was old enough to see him on TV and interviews and things like that. He was always with Noelle, or most of the time he was, and he seemed happy to talk about it. But you could kind of, in the way he talked about stories and such, you could get the sense that it was more of a gradual kind of opening up to him, that he was a little had a little bit more difficulty over time with sort of dealing with the legacy of the show and the fallout. So I'm kind of not surprised by what you're saying.
You're a two-time loser. Armed robbery in 39, felonious assault in 44. You know what happens if we clip you now?
Well, I didn't do nothing.
You broke into Miss Lane's apartment.
That wasn't me.
Who was it?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, punk. You want to play tag? We'll play tag.
What about you? I keep calling him Robert Shane, but you knew him and call him Bob. Was he another one you reached out by letter and eventually it grew from there?
And the same day that I had lunch with Ellsworth, after lunch, we drove to Bob Shane's place and sat and talked with him for some time. He was nearly blind by that time, however. And I remember my daughter was, it was my wife and myself and our daughter. And she was 10 at the time. And he wanted to get a look at her, but he had to take her over to the window, to the light, to be able to see what she looked like. And by the end of his life, then he was, he lived another 10 years after that. And by that time, he was virtually blind.
I recall when he appeared on the Flash television show in 1990, I was a fan. And it went one season, but I was a big fan at the time. And I was so happy when he popped up and made an appearance on the show. I always get a thrill when they're brought back for
and a love. He said they treated me like royalty. He was so pleased to do that.
That's great.
There are one or two things I haven't got quite straight in my mind, Mr. Kent. For example, how did you leave here later than we did and beat us to the airport?
Is that all?
Not quite. How come you found the man behind the hangar at just the right moment to get his exclusive story when every top experienced reporter in the business was breaking his neck?
Or her neck.
Or her neck to get that story.
Maybe I'm a Superman, Miss Lane.
Another person I wanted to ask you about, one I'm particularly fond of, is Phyllis Coates, who played, of course, Lois in that first season. What was her sort of perspective on all this when you first started talking to her?
Well, you know, Phyllis left the series after the first season. She had a chance to do a pilot for NBC that she thought was going to sell. And so when Whit called about a second season, she turned him down. She was betting on the NBC series. And that didn't sell. But by the time she learned that, it was too late and Noelle had been signed. So I think sometimes Phyllis felt she tried to downplay her role in the series, saying that, well, it really wasn't too important to me. But in fact, I think it was. She was certainly an excellent, no-nonsense Lois Lane. She was tough. Phyllis had a certain quality that came across very well on screen. So in later years, she did some appearances supporting or as Lois Lane, but she never really wanted people to think that she was sorry she left. I don't quite know how to explain it. I think she was sorry that she left. But she didn't want to convey that to people. She wanted them to think that, you know, she was quite all right and, you know, everything was okay. She went on to do, she was in Perry Mason episodes, Untouchables. You know, she did quite a bit of work after that.
Were you surprised when she came back on Lois and Clark to play Terry Hatcher's mother that series?
I wasn't surprised because she told me she was going to do that, and she was really pleased to do it. She was sorry that she couldn't continue that role, but she had there was a problem with her son, and there was a mix-up in communication with the producers of Lois and Clark, and she missed out on the opportunity to play that role a second time, and I think Beverly Garland took over the role then.
I did always wonder why she didn't reappear in the series later, because, again, I was very excited to see her pop up in the show.
Well, it was just a miscommunication and missed opportunity.
Just for people listening, I'm very fond of Phyllis Coates' interpretation of Lois, and she has always been my favorite interpretation of the character in live action. There's just something about that sort of hard-nosed reporter, the 1940s sensibility that she captured really well. And she, you know, she had her moments of punching or hitting. You know, she was not a wallflower in the series by any means. She was also quite the screamer. She had a wonderful scream.
Yes. And I loved her voice. I just loved her voice. I remember sitting in college. I'd get together with some other guys in college, and we'd sit around and at lunchtime and eat pizza or whatever. And we were sitting there one day, and the conversation turned to who would you like to meet? What celebrity would you like to meet? And I said right away, Phyllis Coates. I just really like to meet her. That was back in 65. I didn't know that, that someday we'd be friends. And I must tell you another story. I enjoyed talking with Phyllis on the phone. And one time we were talking and I heard water running. And I said, Phyllis, are you washing your dishes or what are you doing? She said, no, I'm in the shower. So I talked to Phyllis Coates in the Lois Lane in the shower.
That's something I'd be tell everyone I could. And I don't mean to take anything away from Noelle Neal, who I also really enjoy. And again, when I met her, she just came off as just an extremely wonderful person and was delightful to talk to and extremely friendly and welcoming to all the fans. And I enjoy in the show. So when I gush about Phyllis Coates, I'm not trying to at all take away from
her. No, I understand because I feel the same way. I loved Noelle. And I, like I said, I considered her a longtime friend and spoke at her memorial service. So, no, I loved her too.
One thing I forgot to mention about Jack Larson that I don't know if people, younger fans, really appreciate what he did for the Jimmy Olsen character, because Jimmy had been in the radio show and then he got brought into the comics and he was in the movie serial as well. But comic wise, he sort of disappeared. He didn't ever really in the '40s or very early 50s have a strong presence in the comic books, and he'd kind of gone away after a while. And it was really Jack Larson's popularity and performance that brought that character back, in not only in the Superman comics, but led to Jimmy getting his own series that, if I remember, I think went 160 or so issues, which is a pretty phenomenal run in comic books.
And Pal Jimmy Olsen, yes. Yes. And Jack was proud of that. And it also led to more opportunities in the television series for Jack. I know that the second episode in the series centered on Jimmy. So he was a major character right from the very beginning. But as it went through the color years, Jack got to, he always wanted to do comedy. And as the episodes progressed through the color years, they became a little more comical, comic book style. And that suited Jack just fine because it gave him an opportunity to do some of the things that he wanted to do. And he always said he came up with ideas for the show. And they said to him, all right, you can try it once. If it doesn't work, we go back to the way it was. And so you get one shot at it. And he usually came through.
Speaking of those later years, I know as the show went on, like you said, it got a lot more humor in it. It got sort of campier in its approach. And there are a few episodes that get a little silly at times. The alien, was it Mr. Zero?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one a lot of people point to. But having said that, I understand that perspective. I don't disagree with it. But I still love those shows. I still love the whole series. And even that one, I really enjoy watching that show, that episode with Mr. Zero.
Well, that was Whit Ellsworth. His concept of the character was that it was a children's character and a children's show. And although he was involved with the first season also, he told me there wasn't any script, any of the 104 scripts that he didn't have his hand in some way. So he was involved heavily in the first season. Although Bob Maxwell was a producer, Whit Ellsworth wrote Superman and the Mole Men, that movie feature that came before the series. But when he became the producer, then he could shape that character in the series in a way that he favored, which was a children's show, and made it more comic book style. And the comic books at that time were children's comic books.
One thing, just on a personal note, I had been frustrated because for about a year or two, I had been unable to find my first season of The Adventures of Superman on DVD around the house, and it was driving me nuts, and I couldn't remember, and finally it dawned on me just a few weeks ago that I had let someone at work borrow it, and that person got fired shortly thereafter, and I, for some reason, I'd lost that memory, so I went and finally bought the bullet and got a copy of it. Fortunately, it's one of the seasons that's still available for a decent price. So over the last couple of weeks, I was going through and slowly rewatching the first season. And for me, I do think the first season is probably my favorite season. Now, having said that, it doesn't really have any of my favorite episodes. You know, some of the episodes I love the most do tend to come from the second season mostly. But
it's the style of the first season that draws people in. They were half hour movies in sort of film noir style, and you can see a big difference in production values as you go from the first season to the second season. They're lighter, brighter, and the heavies are not as sinister. So yes, there was a big leap from the first to the second.
Now, you also talked to some of the guest stars who appeared on the show over the years, and there's quite a few of them who were not on just once or twice, but, you know, reappeared 5, 6, 7 times in different roles, because that was the nature of television at the time, and these were, you know, hardworking, successful TV actors. Of those people, are there any in particular that jump out of your memory that you have particularly fond experiences interacting with, or you just found them particularly enjoyable to talk to?
Robert Rockwell, who played Jor-El in the first series, we had lunch together. In 2001, a friend and I persuaded the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors to proclaim Superman Week, and that would have been the 50th anniversary of the series. So we had a ceremony in Los Angeles, and we had Robert Rockwell there, and Jeff Corey, who's in Superman and the Mole Man. He played Luke Benson. Joanna Siegel was there, Jerry Siegel's wife, Jerry Siegel's daughter, Paul Levitz from DC Comics at that time, and Michael Walbrecht, who was an executive at Warner's. So we had this ceremony, and then we all went to the lunch together, and I sat with Robert Rockwell, and we were talking about his experience. He remembered... It was 2 days' work, and I asked him if he doesn't mind telling me how much he got paid for that. And he said, no, I don't mind telling you. He said, I'm not proud of it, but it was $50 a day that he got paid for Jor-El.
I'm glad you got to meet him. I love that episode. That is one of my all-time favorite tellings of the origin of Superman. Mm-hmm. And I get a kick out of the actor and actress who played the parents. I love the scenes on Krypton. Both as Jor-El and Laura, and also that damn Kryptonian council that will just never listen. So that's wonderful. Now, I do have to ask, now, how much of, you know, your fandom and your love for this comes from Superman, and how much comes from George Reeves in particular?
It's George Reeves. The Superman character is secondary to George. I don't know what it is. I don't try to explain it. It's there. I felt a connection with George. He was just the perfect Superman and Clark Kent. By the way, I especially like his Clark Kent. I would have enjoyed seeing a Clark Kent series with him playing a reporter. So it's George that I connect with. And I came close to meeting him. In 1957, he and Noel and Nadi Bassio and a couple other musicians went on a tour of state fairs. And he performed in Reading, Pennsylvania, which was not more than 15 miles from my home, but I didn't know it at the time. I only found out when I was doing research later in about 1990 or so that I was within 15 miles of him. And it was the last stop on that fair tour, and I missed it. Clayton Moore was there the night before, and then George Reeves on September 15th, and that was the last stop.
Of course, anyone who isn't aware, Clayton Moore is the Lone Ranger.
Yes.
Who was quite active in touring and meeting fans for the rest of his life.
What were you reading? Anything interesting?
As a matter of fact, Lois, I wasn't reading. I was sitting here thinking.
What about?
About Corrigan. His attitude this afternoon.
Oh, he's just a fool.
I don't know. I think I'll drive out to the well.
What for?
Oh, nothing. Look around. Maybe talk to the watchman.
Good idea. I'll go with you.
Now, Lois, what do you possibly expect to find out there this time of night?
What do you expect to find, Mr. Kent?
All right. Come along.
I do want to echo, and well, first I should mention, I'm a lifelong Superman fan. I love Superman's my favorite comic book character. I love multiple interpretations on the big screen and the small screen and in animation and such. But really, what always stood out to me about this show, and one of the reasons, and I watched it from a very young age. I used to watch the reruns in the 70s and early 80s as a kid because they were still played locally where I live. But it was George Reeves and Clark Kent. And I'm going to echo what you said, but to me, he is the best Clark Kent we've ever gotten in any interpretation of the character. And what I loved about him was he, and again, I'm not to repeat what you're saying exactly, but he was a reporter. We got to see him be tough, particularly in those earlier seasons. He wasn't the nerdy kind of Christopher Reeve version we saw, or sometimes mousy character in the comics. We got to see him be a strong reporter, standing up for himself, you know, get in a few scrapes himself over the years, and we got to see him investigate in that role. And those were really high points, and that stuff we don't get to see. More recent years we could finally have, but we didn't get to see Clark doing that sort of thing a lot in live action. And if he did, he had to kind of play the nerdy, kind of timid version. And I'm not a big fan of that version. I like the George Reeves version. He's ideal Clark. Right.
And someone mentioned to me last week, you know, George did very little to differentiate himself, to differentiate Superman from Clark Kent. The hair is combed the same way. The only thing he does is put on a pair of glasses. But his mannerisms are the same. His voice is the same. And yet we still bought that difference. And there was a time watching when I watched as a kid that I wasn't sure that was the same person. He somehow manages to do it without even trying. For me anyway. And that's, I want to believe. That's part of it.
A few times it would jump out at me as a little odd and awkward in the show, when particularly in the early first and second season, when Lois would make a crack kind of diminishing Clark, like he was kind of wimpy, or he laughing about the possibility of him being Superman being ridiculous. And it was kind of a nod to the comic books. But it didn't feel very consistent with a lot of the rest of the show. That wasn't how Clark was portrayed most.
The very first thing Clark does when he comes to Metropolis is walk out on the ledge on 28 stories above the street and comes into Perry White's office, which is not a very mild-mannered thing to do.
Now, as the seasons went on, they did kind of play up that aspect of Clark a little more. At least the comments by Lois increased in frequency more and stuff, and sort of Clark laughing off. But even so, he still never played that timid version of Clark. Even in the later seasons, he was still the reporter and could be tough when he needed to be.
There's only one instance when George shows timidity or and that's in Jet Ace, when Perry White's nephew is test flying a plane, and they're listening to him on the radio, and they sense that something is wrong. Clark has to get out of the office, and so he just says, I can't stand this anymore. I've got to get out. And that's the only time that he ever did that.
I also enjoyed when Clark would have like a friend from out of town pop in, or someone right? There'd be references to sort of him having social life or things outside of, because Clark Kaiser wasn't always allowed to have that in other versions of the character. So it was, I believe Hugh Beaumont played an old friend of his in one of the episodes. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. Dan Grace.
Yeah. And he is, of course, anyone too young to know this, he played the father on Leave It to Beaver for many years.
And Robert Lowry played an old friend of Clark Kent's too. And Robert Lowry with Batman in the 49 serial? Batman was 43 and 49, right?
The two. Yeah, thanks. I totally forgot. I'd heard that once and completely forgot that he was on the show as well.
So Batman and Superman were together, sort of.
Now, being sort of active and meeting all these people and going to all these events over the years and sort of being involved in sponsoring and organizing a lot of these things, how do you feel? Are you happy with the show's legacy all these years later? Are you kind of happy with its place in the Superman mythology? Are you happy with sort of how it's remembered and how George is remembered?
Yes, I'm delighted with it. There's still a large following, what I consider large, certainly not the same as a modern film, but there is a diehard fans, and I'm hoping to do another luncheon next year in Los Angeles if COVID doesn't prevent that. I had a luncheon in 2014, 2018 in Los Angeles. I had another one in Sarasota in 2015, several dinners in New York, 2009, 2015. And we always have a large turnout, and the interest in the series is, the love for the series is there. Anybody who loves the series has loved it for a long time.
Now, is it still possible to get anyone who is on the show to participate in these luncheons, or has everyone sort of passed on at this point?
The only person left is Phyllis, and she's 94. The last time was 2014 when we hosted Jack. There's an episode from the second season, The Man Who Could Read Minds, that was filmed in Tarzana. On location. It was the only time that all five characters were out on location together. And we found that exact spot. It's on Wilbur Avenue in Tarzana. And we had a plaque made up and installed the plaque there in 2014. Press was there and Jack was there. And it was so much fun to stand there on the street. And he was looking around because in the episode, he and Lois are there. They get in the car and they drive away, and he sees the phantom burglar come out of a house. And they stop the car. Jimmy runs out and tackles the phantom burglar and loses the fight with him, but they tackled him. And Jack was standing there trying to remember in which direction he ran after the bad guy, and he just had a great day that day.
You know, I can't let this pass, because you mentioned earlier at the luncheon that Joanne Siegel was there.
Yes.
Of Jerry. Was she or, you know, her husband before he passed, were they frequent sort of visitors to these events? Were they active in this sort of thing?
The only time I met Joanna was in 2001, and I've remained close to her daughter. Her daughter came to the others. As a matter of fact, her daughter was there when we unveiled that plaque that I just talked about. But I don't know that she did any other appearances. I just can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay, I was just curious. Dropping a name like that, I have to follow up and see any history there.
Did she met Noel Neal at that ceremony in 2001. I forgot to mention Jeff Corey and Robert Rockwell, but Noel and Jack were there too. And so Joanna Siegel got to meet Lois Lane.
When they're meeting her, is it a very kind of a friendly, casual kind of, or do they kind of understand how amazing that is to people like us to see them together?
I think Joanna did, and Noel too, but I think Joanna felt it more than Noel did.
So I don't want to keep you much longer, but
hey, I'm enjoying this.
Oh, good. I'm glad, because I love hearing this stuff, and I love all these people, because, you know, and it wasn't quite the same because it was in reruns for me, but I still was probably, you know, I don't know if I can even remember when I first saw the show, because it was just something that was sort of there. And, you know, so when you see something like this as a kid, you're just naturally going to have this kind of nostalgic love for both the characters and these actors and stuff. And it did. When I first met Noelle Neal, and really, sadly, she was the only one from the show I ever did get to meet. I never saw Jack Larson anywhere, and I'm not aware of Phyllis Coates ever really being involved in conventions and stuff. She may have been. I just never really run into that myself. But it was kind of overwhelming. I kind of had to kind of stop myself from kind of tearing up a little, because I was like, oh, I've been seeing this woman for 25 years on TV and I'm meeting her.
One of the first times I was with Jack in person was 95. I was in California to do a segment of Unsolved Mysteries on George's death, and Jack participated in that also. It was taped at a house in Los Angeles someplace, I don't know where anymore, but they taped the interviews in the morning, and then we had a break for lunch, which was catered by Cosgrove Muir Productions. And we were sitting in this garage. They rented a house to tape the episode. We were sitting in the garage eating lunch, and it just struck me that I'm looking across, and there's Jack Larson. Jimmy Olsen is sitting across the table from me. And, you know, I just... momentarily, I was taken back to 1953, sitting in my living room, watching Jimmy Olsen on television, on a little 13-inch television, and just wondering who are these people, and then there I was sitting, having lunch with him in a garage in Los Angeles. And I guess I was staring, because he turned to me and he said, "Jim, are you all right?" And I said, "Yes, Jack, I'm fine."
Yeah, again, I don't know if people nowadays would appreciate how important a character he was, an actor he was to that show at the time, because he was the viewer. He was the young person that Superman's pal, you know, like in the comic. He was the one you felt like you could be in his shoes. And I don't know if in TV shows and movies they necessarily feel the need to sort of have that like they did then. It was, I think, a more common trope at the time. But he was a huge part of that show's success. And I'm not sure if the Jimmy Olsen character would have existed a few years later if he had not started playing him in that show.
Probably not. But television, you know, you have to go back. Television was brand new in 1953. Today, people know actors. They communicate with them on Twitter. They follow them in social media. When I watched television in the 50s, these were strange, really strange beings. Who were these people? And like Dabbs Greer would show up on Superman one week and the Lone Ranger the next week, and it was all very mystifying to me as a kid, and I couldn't imagine them having lives, you know, going home and eating dinner and going to the movies or whatever they did. That just didn't occur to me. The only time they existed was when I turned on the television, and they were just special people to me. So when I sat across from Jack, that was an amazing moment.
This is a very specific question that I meant to ask you earlier and forgot, so I don't want to miss it and lose this again. But when did you first realize that there were seasons or episodes in color?
Not until 1965. They were filmed in color, of course, starting in 54, but they were never broadcast in color. And so In 1995, I remember reading in TV Guide or someplace that Superman was going to be shown in color. And by that time, I had graduated high school in 64. And so I was reading this and I thought, I didn't understand where does this color come from? And in my mind, I thought somebody must have taken each film and colored it some way. And it was only later then that I figured out what was going on. But I remember talking to Whit Ellsworth about it too. And I asked him whose idea it was to go to color. And he said he persuaded Kellogg's to foot the bill for color. But even George didn't see more than a few feet of color film. They just didn't make any color prints of any of the episodes. They just did a few to sort of see what they were getting. But so nobody saw it really in color until 65.
Okay, so you read about it before you first laid eyes on it. You sort of knew. Okay, because I was going to ask if you just sort of turned on the TV one day and was like, what the am I looking at here? Because I imagine for a lot of people they did. They saw it. And for anyone listening who's not quite sure what we're talking about, as Jim kind of alluded to, the show started filming in black and white, and probably some of you have seen the costume he wore, which is more of a brown and gray kind of design because that's what showed up better in black and white. And Jim is wearing a shirt that matches that. Oh, I always love that picture. I got to see that one. Oh, I'll get to that in a minute. But so eventually, as he said, they did change to start filming in color, but at the time they didn't actually get aired that way. And I have always heard stories of people not finding out for many years or decades later that it even existed in color, because they just never saw that as a child. And it wasn't until catching reruns 20 years later that they first saw that.
I remember the first glimpse of the color costume that I got. The first episode I watched that was in color was The Lucky Cat. And Clark changes to Superman and goes into a basement and holds up the floor that's going to fall through. And a lot of people have said to me over the years, you know, why did he have to change to Superman? Clark could have just gone. Nobody else was around. He could have gone and held it. And well, of course, they wanted to show off that costume eventually.
I almost said earlier, I got to see that original costume eventually when I was about 15. My parents and I took our whole family took a trip to California that was about a month long. We visited all the big cities, and we even took a break to go over to Las Vegas nearby. And I was driving down the street one day, and I don't know if it was just a big sign or it was a full billboard or something, and it was like this Superman event, you know, Superman display or something. So, of course, I'd been reading comics, and my parents knew how much I loved Superman. So we stopped, and I went in, and it was just this kind of almost like a gym or a warehouse type deal, and they had all this memorabilia. And many years later after reading, I've wondered if it may have been the Smithsonian stuff touring afterwards. I never went to the Smithsonian show. I don't know what was there on the anniversary, but it may have been this. But they had several of the different costumes over the years, including a version of the gray and brown one, the George Reeves. And of all the things I saw there, and I saw they had one of Christopher Reeves' costumes, but there was just something particularly cool about the visual of that gray brownish costume. I just love that. Was the coolest thing I saw at that exhibit, because I just won the history behind it and it being one of the oldest items there, but just that visual is so striking when you see it. I love that moment.
It's a beautiful costume. Both the black and white and the color costumes are beautiful.
George, what he had a great bearing when he was Superman, the way he presented, and like you said, he didn't play himself tremendously different whether he was Clark or Lois. But I loved his poses and the way he stood as Superman, you know, the chest out. There was just something that really sold
the
character.
At the same time, there's something that I've always detected. If you watch the Kirk Allen serials, Kirk played him as he's very boastful. He stands there with his hands on his hips and almost smirks at the criminals. George, while he was supposedly the strongest man in the world as Superman, but he always had a soft side to him, a human side that I don't see in any of the other characterizations of Superman. So yes, he did stand, and it was just a quiet strength. He knew that he was powerful, but he didn't have to show it. He didn't have to demonstrate that power. And at the same time, like with the episode with the Around the World with Superman, you know, there he was again, the most powerful man in the world, but he took time to help that girl regain her sight. And that's another person I really wanted to. You asked if there was anybody that I didn't talk to that I would have liked to, and Judy Nugent is that one person. I didn't think of it before, but I would love to talk to Judy. As far as I know, she lives in Montana. I had talked with her son, and her son tried to connect me with her, but it just didn't work out. She doesn't. She's not too interested in reliving the past. I did manage to talk with the other girl that Superman flew, and that was in the birthday letter of the first season, Issa Asher.
The girl with the bracelet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And she and I are friends, and she had not seen that episode in a long, long time when I sent it to her, and then she showed it to her kids, and they had not ever seen it. And
in that episode, the three bad guys, one of whom is not really a bad guy, as we learn as the show goes on. I can't remember his character's name, but he was very over-exaggerated in his...
Slugger, yeah.
Did you ever get an opportunity to speak with that actor? I'm not sure how long he's
been. No, I have good friends with his son. The actor is John Doucette, and he and his son and I are good friends.
Okay, I've seen him in many other things over the years, and he's usually very different than he was in that Superman show. That's not representative of his acting. If anyone ever sees it, he's doing that for the character. He's not like that. I've seen him play much darker and more ominous type of characters in other roles. He was great at it.
He was in Patton with George C. Yeah. That was the one moment. That episode, however, when they take the girl's braces off, that bothers me. It bothered me when I was a kid, and it still bothers me. That was a bad moment.
I know exactly what you're saying, and it is kind of startling when you see it, because seeing a child, and they kidnapped the child, so I'm not going to act like there wasn't some negativity towards a child, but to see any sort of brutal physical...
Right, you take it off and she screamed, don't do that. And they continue to remove the braces.
Yeah, it's a difficult scene to sit through in the context, even in that first season, where things did get a little darker. And
because Kellogg's, you know, when Kellogg's agreed to sponsor the show, they took a look at what they had, and they had some material that they wanted taken out. B-Evil 3, pushing the woman down the ramp. On that wheelchair, they had that removed, and there were a couple other scenes that they excised, but Kellogg's allowed that one to remain, and I could never quite understand their thinking on that.
Were you surprised that Kellogg allowed them to keep the scene of the couple he left on the mountain? Because that was always one. As a kid, I was like, wait a minute, did he just? For anyone listening, there's an episode where this couple finds out his identity, and he takes them to this mountaintop, you know, blizzardy mountain. It's kind of a Mount Everest type thing, and leaves them there. And the implication is he's going to come back for them, but they almost immediately try to climb down the mountain and fall to their death. And it's kind of like, did he know they were going to, you know, was he setting them up for that? It's kind of an awkward thing. Do you think Kellogg, were you surprised they let that one go?
I've been arguing about that episode for a long time, and whether Superman really was acting as a vigilante there. And that was originally a radio program, a radio script. As a matter of fact, there are two versions of it during the radio years. And it's almost word for word from the radio script. That was Maxwell. Bob Maxwell, he just had a different interpretation of Superman, and That was his stamp on the series.
Am I remembering right? That's not a first season episode, right? That's a second.
No, it's first.
Oh, it is the first? Okay.
Yeah. Stolen costume. T-Ball breaks into Clark Kent's apartment and finds the costume in the closet.
Is there anything else you kind of want to mention about the legacy of the show or your experiences in meeting these people over the years?
Well, it's just been a great experience for me, and my daughter started going with me in 2001 to that luncheon that I mentioned with Robert Rockwell. That was her first trip with me, and she has the whole experience of loving the series and George Reeves has brought about so many friendships, people from all over the world, Australia, Brazil, and it's brought my daughter and me closer together. And now my grandson goes along. He's an audiovisual kind of guy, and he records the luncheons for me. And my great grandson went along to the Sarasota event, and so for me, it has opened up so many opportunities and so many friendships, and that's really what I enjoy most about it.
The last question I wanted to ask you is, do you know the actor Jim Beaver?
Yes, we're good friends.
And for people listening, if you don't know the name, he was on, you'll probably know him either from Supernatural, where he played Bobby, or also possibly from Deadwood, where he played a character named Whitney Ellsworth, who is indeed named after Superman editor and producer, because Jim Beaver is a big fan of George Reeves and the show as well. And I guess what I wanted to ask in the follow-up is, are we ever going to get that biography that he's been working on?
Yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact, he has shared several chapters with me. He is working on it. So far, he's up to chapter 5, which takes us up to 1935. And yes, I'm confident we'll see it.
I cannot wait for that book. I've been waiting for someone. I know it's not an easy thing.
And we email back and forth several times a month, and he'll have a question that he thinks I might be able to answer, and or know someone who can. And he's a stickler for detail. He documents everything, and I think it's going to be a top-notch biography when it finally comes out. And as far as his Whitney Ellsworth character, the in Deadwood, the character had a last name, Ellsworth, and when it came time to give him a first name, Jim suggested Whitney, and they accepted that, so he became Whitney Ellsworth.
Okay. Well, when you talk to him, please let him know that there are some of us out here who are just dying.
Oh, he knows. He knows. As a matter of fact, he spoke at the luncheon in 2014. He was one of the featured speakers, and he apologized for taking so long with it. But all I can say is that it will be worth the wait.
So my last thing is, I just want to sort of thank you generally for all the work you've done over the years, all the research, all documenting your interviews with these people, the information they've given you, because, we live in such an easy time for fans with the internet out there. And we don't appreciate that a lot of the stuff that's out there on the internet now, when we want to learn about these shows and these actors, comes from people of your generation doing the hard detective work and actually not having to get out there and write letters and travel and meet and research and go through pages of documents and scripts and notes. And it's just, it was a different world. And so much we know about George Reeves as a person and about this show and the other people involved comes from people like yourself who, in decades of work you put into it. So really, as a fan that came along later, thank you so much for all you did.
Welcome, and enjoy sharing it. There's a lot of people ask me if they expect when they meet me for me to have a lot of things. And I said, I always tell them I'm not interested in having things. I don't collect things. I like to collect information, because information is so much easier to share with everybody than things are. If you have you know, if you have artifacts, what do you do with it? You set it in the corner of your room or behind the, you know, in a safe or whatever, depending on how valuable it is. But you can't, it's difficult to share all of those items, but information you can share. And that's what I enjoy doing every day on Twitter and on Facebook. I look at some of the letters that during this pandemic, I decided to go through all the letters that I have. I have hundreds of letters from Dabbs Greer, and I'm scanning all of them and scanning them into my computer. And I look at some of the questions that I asked, and I was so naive back in the 80s and when I first met them. But we've learned a lot, yes.
Well, your enthusiasm and your love must have really come across to these people, because for so many of them to not only have answered back, but to have gone the extra step and actually started, you know, meeting this fan and going, I mean, that's not something actors and, you know, people behind the scenes did very often at the time. Your love must have really come across.
After Whit Ellsworth died, I kept in contact with his wife, Jane, for another 10 years before she passed away. And it was a few months after Whit died that she wrote to me, and she said, she paid me the biggest compliment. She said, Whit felt a kindred spirit with me, and he thought of me as a son. And indeed, he thought of George as a son too. George often called him Dad. And so I like to think that I had the same connection with Whit Ellsworth that George did at one time.
That's lovely. Although hearing you, George, talking about someone as a father figure is interesting, because to me, his Superman kind of always felt like a father figure type Superman to me when I was a little kid, in a way that some of the other Superman didn't. So it's interesting to think of him viewing
George someone. Didn't have a father. His parents divorced soon after he was born, and Helen, his mother, moved to California, where she met and married Frank Besolo, and Frank adopted George, and he became George Besolo. And that marriage didn't last either. And Helen, his mother, she lied to George a lot. She had told George that his real father committed suicide. Then when she divorced Frank Besolo, she told George that Frank committed suicide. And I'm glad he found a father figure in Whit Ellsworth. But yes, it was there.
Jim, thank you again for all that you've done. And it sounds like you not only have helped make a lot of fans happy over the years, but you've helped to make these people, these actors and other creators on the show, very happy as well. And that's really lovely to hear. And I talk a lot about the legacy of the show, but you've left a pretty good legacy yourself. And on behalf of other fans, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the show. And thank you for joining us. And please check out Jim's social media presence on Twitter, the group we mentioned on Facebook earlier, also his website. There's so much information out there he's still sharing with us all. So please check it out. And with that, goodbye.
Don't miss the next thrill-packed episode in the amazing adventures of Superman. Superman is based on the original character appearing in Superman magazine. We'll be right back.